He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week we look at a controversy over the use of AI at the New Zealand Herald, and we ask, should we be told when technology has created the content? Or are we all that bothered anyway in the digital days we live in now? Also, an unconvincing complaint about the All Blacks spurning our media.
Look, for Hosking, if he can't get an All Black on the show, he needs to build some relationships.
But first, we look at how our media made winners out of those who didn't strike gold in Paris.
And how do you rest up ahead of the mixed relay?
Yeah, obviously 24 hours. Hopefully I can decompose within there and then on Monday. So yeah, obviously got like 3 or 4 days to kind of digest everything and then give everything for the relay. I think we've got an outside chance.
Let's hope he doesn't decompose too much before that mixed relay event on Monday. That was triathlete Hayden Wilde in Paris last Wednesday, our time, talking to RNZ's Felicity Reid just after he was pipped at the post for a gold medal. And 2 hours later, Nathan Rarity told Morning Report about his parents in tears in Paris.
Oh, it's so much parental crying. It was beautiful.
And then Ingrid Hipkiss asked his grandparents about stressing out when watching it on TV back in Turangi.
We were sweating. It was just such a heart-beating moment. It was absolutely amazing.
And after that...
I know you celebrated with a red wine. How does it hit when you're in super peak form?
Oh, absolutely. Just went straight to the head. I sat down and did an interview and I stood up and I was like, dare, I dare. But okay, it makes the interviews flow, to be honest.
It does. It's good. Well, look, I mean... Now,
in general terms, preloading before media interviews is not really recommended, though Hayden Wilde was pretty impressive in all his media chats. But all that was just the coverage of him on Morning Report and for a silver medal. On Thursday night, the rowers were lining up for a series of finals when Sky's Andrew Mulligan seemed terrified of tempting fate.
We have what could potentially be a golden hour coming up, and it's exciting. We're very much anticipating a successful morning here.
And three more medals were won, rocketing New Zealand up the rankings. But just 2 days earlier, our media were angsting about our athletes yet to trouble the medal table, with Morning Report's Ingrid Hipkiss telling Twitchy listeners this on Tuesday.
A quick look at our medals at the last five Olympics show that we have often gotten off to a bit of a slow start. Beijing, Athens and Sydney, well, our first medals there came after more than a week, so we've got ages to go for that. They were from rowers like Mahe Drysdale after 9 days at Beijing and the Evers Swindell sisters in Athens. That happened after 9 days.
And in the absence of podium finishes, we had interviews like this one on News Talk ZB explaining that the swimming pool wasn't long enough.
Let's bring in Olympic lead for swimming New Zealand, Gary Francis. Gary, another 20 metres, and I reckon Erica would probably have gotten that bronze medal.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Jason. I think that she just ran out of metres at the end there.
Now, there was plenty more where that came from until our rowers got into their groove. Hayden Donnell looked at that in this week's Midweek Media Watch. If you missed it, it's on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, our section of the RNZ app, or you'll find it in our podcast feed. And while he was at it on Wednesday, Hayden talked about uncovering the first instance that we know of AI being used in New Zealand to write a newspaper's editorial.
An editorial published in last weekend's Weekend Herald was written by artificial intelligence. It was about who the All Blacks should pick to play at centre.
But after those revelations last Wednesday, what next? Well, here's Hayden with an update.
A story about the All Blacks centre dilemma leads the Viewpoints page in the July 20 edition of the Weekend Herald. It also features in other weekend papers published by the Herald's owner NZME, such as the Bay of Plenty Times and the Gisborne Herald. The All Blacks find themselves at a crucial juncture, it begins. But after that, things get a little weird. There's a lengthy and, to be honest, boring paragraph on the nature of the centre position. Some of the language is a bit off. The English team's defence supposedly exposed chinks in the All Blacks' attacking armour. And there's repetition. Besides that crucial juncture, the All Blacks also find themselves at a crossroads. A source who contacted Media Watch earlier this week pointed out that some of these quirks are telltale signs of AI-generated text. And that would be an issue, partly because the article doesn't mention AI having been used. We put some of those suspicions to the test, running the editorial through various AI detection tools, several of which returned positive results. When we put those to the Weekend Herald's publisher NZME, its editor-in-chief Murray Kirkness conceded in a statement to Media Watch that AI had been used in the editorial in a way that wasn't up to scratch.
Any piece of content that uses AI is reviewed, edited, and has journalistic oversight. In this particular case, we accept more journalistic rigour would have been beneficial. And we will communicate this to our team.
By 10 p.m. that night, the Herald had added an editor's note to the story which said, AI was used in the original production of this column. It was edited on July 31 to provide more journalistic oversight. But that wasn't quite that. After we ran our story and aired it on Midweek Media Watch, several people got in touch questioning other Herald analysis pieces and editorials. Putting some of them through the same process yielded similar results. In the case of a July 10 editorial headlined Eden Park Under Siege as England Seek Redemption Over All Blacks, 3 of 4 detection tools thought AI had been used. 3 of 4 also pointed to AI-generated copy in a July 24 editorial headlined Warriors NRL Playoff Dreams Teeter After Narrow Loss to Canberra Raiders. 4 of 4 thought it had been used in the May 29 editorial, Rugby's Future in New Zealand at Stake, Pivotal Vote on Governance Reform Tomorrow. And 4 of 4 thought it had been used in a piece of analysis headlined All Black Selections, Scott Robertson's Tough Call to Combine Tradition with Transformation at Lock. None of these detection programs are foolproof. They shouldn't be taken as definitive. That's a vital caveat. It may be that the articles in question comply with NZME's AI policy, which allows AI to be used to aid in article construction, provided there's journalistic oversight. But when we asked NZME for clarification on whether some of these stories had been written with the help of AI, it said it had nothing more to add. Nothing more to add to us, anyway. All NZME editorial staff have been encouraged to attend a meeting next week about the company's use of AI. It should be an illuminating meeting. If any staff want to let us know what they learn, please don't hesitate to get in touch.
Hayden Donnell there with an update on the controversy over the New Zealand Herald's use of AI. Now, as you heard there, NZME, the Herald's publisher, would not be interviewed on Media Watch this week about it, and its sole statement to Media Watch so far, issued on Wednesday, said many media companies use AI tools in their newsrooms, and they do. But how and what is considered best practice? Well, Peter Bale is a media consultant and commentator who previously worked overseas for big news companies like Reuters, the Financial Times and CNN, and he's even written editorial policy for some of those. And up until last year, Peter Bale was also the newsroom initiative leader for the International News Media Association, which promotes innovation and good practice in news publishing.
News organisations around the world are using generative AI, that is AI that creates content as opposed to just making recommendations, all the time now. People are using it to generate stories, to analyse large documents. I mean, one of the best uses that I have seen is in analysing a really large health report from The Lancet or something like that. It is extremely good, or it can be extremely good, in extracting the bullet points or helping you understand the key points of any given document. So it's really how you use it, what you use it for, and how clearly you disclose it to your readers that you are, in fact, using these tools.
Well, in terms of disclosure, the policy at NZME, the publisher of the New Zealand Herald, says we remain committed to our code of ethics and the integrity of our journalism, regardless of whether we use AI tools or not, for the production and processing of articles. So they're saying we don't need to disclose it. The human oversight is there. Our code of ethics is the important thing. So does that mirror the policies of big overseas publishers?
Probably the best practice is disclosure on each story, using generative AI to create an entirely new article. Even if it's based on existing material, it is probably worth actually disclosing that. Certainly in these initial years, as we're getting used to it, disclosing it within the article. Using AI, for example, to suggest search engine optimization terms, then I don't think that sort of thing is required. Or where you have an editor in the way. So, for example, if you have digested a huge medical report from The Lancet, I'm not sure that it's absolutely necessary to disclose that you use generative AI to do that, to help you do that summary. However, I did read just this morning, yet again, the Herald's disclosure statement, and it's pretty comprehensive. And I'm aware that the Herald is taking this and using it as a learning opportunity. And I think we should, you know, be glad that they're doing that. You know, they haven't made some sort of egregious error. They've just produced something that isn't quite as good as they would have wished. I must admit, I've never seen, or I haven't seen, examples of people using generative AI to produce editorials, which are normally really the voice of the paper. And in this case, it would appear to be that they have digested or asked probably ChatGPT to deliver an analysis of, I think it was Gregor Paul stories that you picked up about the All Blacks.
That's correct.
So that was I think that's a reasonable exercise to go through to give you the base for an editorial perhaps, but not necessarily just to publish it in the way that was done. And we can all learn from it.
Yeah, we understand that some New Zealand newsrooms are using AI tools to, for example, shrink down the size of their stories to, once they've written them to say 1,000 yes. words, to shrink them down to, let's say, you know, 750. That Herald editorial and perhaps the one below it about Israel Adesanya, those were both referencing articles written by the Herald's own mm-hmm. people, such that editorial writers often do. They'll paraphrase what their own staff have said and amplify the points they make. If they're only rejigging their journalist's own work and using AI tools, does that seem like a legitimate use and one that need not necessarily be disclosed to a reader?
Well, I think this was an editorial. It is supposed to be the kind of masthead statement by the paper. So you would hope that it at least reads well and isn't clunky. It should be a really beautifully put together item. But we're not talking here about plagiarism or deliberately or accidentally inserting errors. I mean, one of the key problems that people discover with generative AI is that it can, what's called, hallucinate and give you an answer that it thinks is the most appropriate, but it may actually be incorrect in the context in which you would normally publish it. So it's very important that these things do get edited and checked. Editing staff on papers have been, cut to the bone. We already have examples where ordinary human-produced journalism isn't as good as you would wish. Business Desk, which is now owned by NZME, did do an amazing job, which I wrote about at the time, processing quite a few thousand New Zealand Stock Exchange announcements. And they managed to do it very, very, very quickly. You know, they had a very high rate of reliability. That's partly because statements from the Stock Exchange are machine readable, are very well presented from a regulatory point of view. So that kind of thing, I think, is fine. But I'm pretty sure they did actually disclose that on each item.
Images is another area where AI can do in seconds what, an art director or a photographer would take a longer time to do. Are there different rules about disclosure? Should the similar principles apply?
Absolutely, they should, if not more significantly. We've been through this kind of problem with the use of Adobe Photoshop and other photo editing tools. Reuters, for example, Reuters News Agency, where I worked for many years, has extremely strict rules on the use of Adobe Photoshop or any other enhancement tools, including cropping. I think the risks are much higher now because you can create such exceptional images. I mean, we all saw those remarkable fake images of Trump being arrested in New York, which looked absolutely sensational. We've probably all seen the great pictures of the Pope wearing a Balenciaga jacket. news media industry or organizations have enough troubles with trust already. One of the best ways to try to retain what trust remains is to be super transparent.
And if policies were more or less aligned, if big publishers all roughly did the same thing, in the end, would that be better, or should they have the flexibility to make up their own policies? As we see, the two major publishers here of news, NZME Stuff, quite different rules for disclosing that to readers.
Well, I think they're slightly different rather than quite different. I think reading the Herald's one, it's certainly in line with what one would imagine best practice to be internationally. It is a question about transparency. And my impression in this case is that they will, in fact, take it as a really important learning example.
That was Peter Bale, media consultant and former editor at Reuters, the Financial Times and CNN, and formerly the newsroom initiative leader at the International News Media Association. So what is it then that we, the audience, actually expect from our media companies when they are using AI? Well, the biggest annual survey of news and media is the Reuters Institute Digital News Report, and this year, for the first time, it asked people in 28 countries how they felt about the integration of AI into news and journalism and their awareness of it. and they found that less than half of people said they know much about AI in the first place. But according to the lead researcher, Dr. Amy Ross Aguedas.
So we find that across all of the countries, only around one third of the respondents say that they feel comfortable using news made mostly by humans with the help of AI, so 36%. And the proportion is even smaller, so just around one in five, when it comes to news that's made mostly by AI with some human oversight.
However, Dr. Aguedas also said that media companies have to be really careful alerting people to their use of AI because it draws people's attention to something that they find alarming or confusing.
So going overboard with labeling, for example, or using language that's really vague, it carries the risk of scaring off people who already tend to have low levels of trusted news. And also people that will have kind of lower levels of knowledge about AI because they're going to tend to default to more negative assumptions. And that's what we've seen in our qualitative data. But at the same time, you know, failing to provide audiences with information that they may want in order to decide what news they want to use and what news they want to trust, that could also prove damaging. So publishers are going to have to thread this needle very carefully.
And here in New Zealand, that's not just an issue for big publishers of news. The monthly trade publication Tradie Magazine markets itself this way.
We meet thousands of tradies every month, so we know what they're thinking and we know what they need. We're their best mate on site, the funniest, toughest, best informed foreman any hardworking hero could ask for.
But the guy that was on the cover of Tradie Magazine in June wasn't one of them. The smiling guy in hi-vis and a helmet was hotly debated on the online forum Reddit when one user discovered that a stock library was selling that image, slugged as happy builder wearing a helmet and reflective vest. The note said, generated with AI, editorial use must not be misleading or deceptive. But there was no such declaration for readers of the June issue of Tradie. So did that matter? Well, it did to Caleb Francis, a digital strategist at the Auckland-based marketing agency Mark, which specialises in brands. On the agency's website, Caleb Francis argued that the media are risking their reputation by using AI images like that one.
The news media in particular has got a reputation to uphold. They need to deliver on what they say they're going to do. AI-generated content, so if it's images or if it's editorial, that sort of thing, it needs to be disclosed.
But it's very unlikely that people would know how news organisations use AI, and as people themselves, individuals who use, the services of, you know, Google or Microsoft or whatever, they'll find, you know, AI things like Microsoft Copilot popping up. Do you think they really would be that bothered about the news media using these tools as well?
Copilot, that's about trying to do the job, trying to do it efficiently, getting the information at hand. AI generated content, it can be misleading. AI brands that are using it, they need to actually be really, really clear about what's going on. These people don't know. And if we don't have, say, policies in place, how do we actually control what's going out there? How do we trust what we are being shared and told?
Well, in this specific instance, though, of the New Zealand Herald, an editorial on July the 20th about the All Blacks, that heavily referenced a piece by one of their own journalists just published a few days before. And we know that journalists do use tools to shorten the length of their stories. Sometimes AI stuff is a bit of a shortcut. People finding out about it now because it's been publicised, do you think that really would be something that readers wouldn't expect, or they would feel their trust had been somehow messed with?
Yeah, so if this is the voice of the paper, but it's actually being generated by AI, who's the voice? Where's it coming from? And at the same time, it's behind a paywall.
The other example that you highlighted was the June edition of Tradie magazine. Mm. And that image, I can recall, it was shown to me saying, do you think this is real, this smiling tradie on the cover of Tradie magazine? But the trade audience reading that magazine, if they were informed that this was an AI-generated image, which they weren't, do you think that changes their mind about what they're reading?
Little by little, especially when we're looking at the trades. Yeah, trades, people are thinking, oh, okay, my job's safe, or how's AI going to take it? How am I going to be displaced? And AI and content is actually not them. It's not representative of them. Tradie magazine often uses real images. Tradie magazine, for instance, how they speak, what they say, basically it's their brand.
All right, so authenticity is the issue there.
Authenticity, transparency, trust is, in terms of brand trust and consumer trust, is, you know, it's nothing new. But now we've got AI-generated content. AI is moving faster than what policymakers can write policies for.
Yeah, and that makes it really difficult for us to work out, for me, to work out what the attitude of the people, the media-consuming people, really is. It makes me think of privacy. If you go back 10 years, people are very concerned and saying, oh, look, all these new digital tools and devices, and the media, you know, could really make hay with this, and I think there's going to be a lot of pushback from the public. However, you know, the public started sharing stuff about themselves, you know, on social media and so on, personal information, which was way beyond things that the media used to dig out. Public attitudes to sharing this stuff went way ahead of the law or the media ethics and principles. So do you think that is possibly happening here with AI as well?
Yeah, this is just an AI-generated image, so what? But like I was saying earlier, this is just step by step. Step by step, this is going to get more and more convincing. People actually, and it's happening, won't know what is real, but it's better to front foot it rather than consumers go, why didn't you tell me about this? You tricked me. Getty Images put out a report and it says almost 90% of consumers globally want to know whether an image has been created using AI. And then this other study from University of Waterloo, only 61% of participants could tell the difference between AI-generated people and real ones. And with the technology getting better and better and better, that's, I think, is going to increase, which is why you need to have these messages.
So for the interests of the media-consuming public, is it your belief that pretty much any use of the technology and the tools should be disclosed on the individual item where it's used that the public are seeing, or even in more detail about exactly how it was used, right down to, say, even like a watermark on altered images, something like that?
I think so. Why wouldn't I want to know? If someone shares it with me, I can say, oh, well, actually, it's not real. This is AI-generated. Part of the brands or media, which we're predominantly talking about, is to inform people, to let them know what is real, so that people are able to be informed to make a decision. So if they expect it, but the media is not delivering it, then how would you feel?
That was Caleb Francis, digital strategist at the Auckland-based marketing agency, Mark. Last weekend here on Media Watch, we looked at how the Prime Minister took political reporters by surprise when he told them he would no longer answer their questions in Parliament on Tuesdays when he's making his way across the tiles to the debating chamber. And that prompted a bit of pushback from the political reporters.
A number of previous Prime Ministers held the same schedule of interviews with media. You're dialing it back.
All you're losing is my tile run, which is 5 minutes on the way into the House.
The Prime Minister said in reply that reporters still had heaps of other opportunities to get answers out of him, and that's true, but his office also recently said they won't routinely hold post-Cabinet press conferences in weeks when Parliament's not sitting either. Now, most in the media said that cutting back media access like this was not a good thing, but not Heather Duplessy-Allen of Newstalk ZB.
What is it that the press gallery want to ask on a Tuesday afternoon that they couldn't have asked on a Tuesday morning, or couldn't wait to ask on a Wednesday afternoon?
Well, surely it depends what the issue is at hand on any given day. But not only was that a surprising response from a former member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, as we pointed out last week, it was also at odds with the reaction in 2021 when the Prime Minister, then Jacinda Ardern, pulled out of regular weekly interviews on Newstalk ZB's Mike Hosking breakfast show.
Holmes, Longy, Douglas, Moore, Bolger, Shipley, Clark, Key, English. Those are a lot of prime ministers who were prepared to front up and be held accountable. It's a long line of democratic history that Jacinda Ardern ended. It's actually not Hosking that the prime minister is no longer speaking to weekly. It's voters. It's me and you.
Now, at that time, Mike Hosking himself said the prime minister was running for the hills because his questions were too tough for her and he was catching her out.
Reports I'd read, she hadn't. The time I asked whether they were replacing the Tauranga City Council, she replied they didn't do such things, clearly not having the slightest clue. they were in a month or so going to do exactly that. Those occasions are too many to be comfortable.
Now, that Tauranga City Council example was an interesting one. At that point, the Department of Internal Affairs had begun the process of inquiring into the Invercargill and Tauranga City Councils and how they could address their chronic leadership problems. The Department of Internal Affairs would then advise the Minister of Local Government if any action needed to be taken under the Local Government Act's regulations, which allow for a minister to intervene if the running of council operations could fail. And that's exactly what is supposed to happen by law in such circumstances. But at the time, the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, responded like this on the Mike Hosking Breakfast.
Why on earth are you making such suggestions?
Because the department has written to both of the councils looking for information that they may involve the role of the minister in them.
And you're suddenly making an assumption that we're going to take over.
Well, that's one of the outworkings of the information they received from the letter they sent
councils.
To them.
Mike, if you've got a list of things that you want to run through this morning, then that is fine.
Were you not aware of the department writing to the councils asking for information of potential ministerial involvement?
No, I think it's a ridiculous suggestion that we would take over a council.
Well, the government did appoint a commissioner to run the council in Tauranga in the end, but not in Invercargill. And just last week, the people of Tauranga elected a new mayor to run their council again. Good news for local democracy, but not for Mike Hosking, it seems, according to his chat with the current Prime Minister last week.
What we need are half a dozen commissioners in this country to kick some ass and get this place going. And enough of the democracy. I mean, look at Tauranga over the weekend. You see that? 31% turnover. People don't want democracy, do they? When given the opportunity, they can't be bothered.
Oh, well, look, I'll always stand up for liberal democracy. I agree with you, Mike. It can be a hell of a lot better.
It's funny, Mike Hosking seemed so against central government taking over local councils, specifically Tauranga, in 2021. Now, one other thing that's been restored by a change of government since then is Mike Hosking's access to the Prime Minister on his show every Tuesday morning, and his encounters with Christopher Luxon are often a lot less hostile. In fact, in that same interview last Tuesday, Mike Hosking asked Christopher Luxon this.
Hey, do you know what I liked about David Seymour as acting Prime Minister last week?
No, tell me.
He told it like it was. Someone asked him a question about the Reserve Bank and he told it like it was. He said, we need relief.
Not so much a question there as an invitation to agree with Mike Hosking. And his listeners have also noticed this change and asked him about it.
Mike, why don't you give him a hard time like you did Jacinda and Shippy? Mate, the reason is he hasn't done anything apart from open up some envelopes and they've all exploded in his face. Let him get his feet under the table.
Stop opening those envelopes, maybe.
Make a few decisions, get a bit of legislation passed, cross off your 100 days, and then in 3 years' time, after a term, when he comes back and has another crack, if things aren't going well, you watch me give him a hard time. You bet I will.
Well, that was back in March, and taken literally, that means a soft ride for the Prime Minister every Tuesday, all the way to 2026. But it seems Mike Hosking didn't get what he wanted from another national leader last week. In the Herald last weekend, the Herald's media insider, who is editor-at-large Shane Curry, reported Mike Hosking as telling his listeners last week the All Blacks were a pain in the ass to deal with, and
they think they're so important that they can't possibly talk to the media unless it suits them.
So what was the problem exactly? Well, the media insider said he understood that Hosking's team wanted to speak to players before the recent tests against England and Fiji, but they had rejected the offer of talking to an All Blacks reserve 5 days out from the Fiji game. Now, as he did after the Jacinda Ardern snub, Mike Hosking told ZB listeners that he really didn't care, and Shane Curry said that would sting New Zealand rugby, which he said is now striving hard to improve media relations with off-the-record briefings and meetings with sports editors and rugby journalists and surveys of journalists for feedback. An NZR spokesman told the Herald that a range of All Blacks and coaches were made available to the media before the Fiji test in San Diego, and players are available for interviews the day before a test match. In fact, they said no fewer than 22 All Blacks were made available at media conferences and other events. And on top of that, Razor Robertson spoke to Sky TV after one of the tests and was even interviewed for a Sky Sport three-part series. And 2 weekends ago, Scott Robertson answered listeners' questions for a full hour on News Talk ZB's Saturday Sports Show. And last week, that prompted News Talk ZB's Heather Duplessy-Allen to ask the host, Jason Pine, this.
Piney, you shouldn't have to beg them for 3 months to come on the show. They should be wanting to go on the sports radio show in the country.
Just to be clear, we didn't beg them to come on. We asked them. We kept on requesting.
So no begging was required then to get a full hour with the All Blacks coach on the same station. And a guest on that same show, ex-NewsHub sports host Andrew Gordy, said this.
I would honestly say it's better now than it probably has ever been. I think what you're saying, Heather, I think New Zealand rugby and their media people actually understand that point of view better than they ever have before. Yeah. But look, for Hosking, if he can't get an All Black on the show, he needs to build some relationships. He needs to get down to their level.
And on top of that, on last weekend's All Sport Breakfast show on ZB, the pundit Paul Allison said Razor Robertson's All Blacks have upped their outreach game in a big way.
Scott Robertson's very aware of that, and I think he's bringing a culture into that side and into that environment, which is going to make them a lot more accessible and a lot more aware of the fact that they are very much part of the public fabric, that we want to be getting access to them. We want to hear their views and thoughts and what have you. And he's leading the charge, and good on him.
This time, in 2024, maybe it's not the All Blacks that need to rethink their media strategy. Well, that's all from Media Watch for this weekend. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday, and then we'll be back again with Media Watch as usual next weekend. Follow Media Watch and listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. Now, if you have any thoughts to share with us or any ideas for us to follow up, do get in touch. You can email us at mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, or you'll find us at MediaWatchNZ on X. And you can even write us an old-fashioned letter and send it to PO Box 123 Wellington. Well, that's all from us for now. Ka kite. Catch you again for Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday night.